Morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Good morning. Doing well.
Good to see you. Ed, how are you?
I'm unmuted. Yeah, I'm doing well. Thank you. I just sent you an email, and it's really busy. It's revenues are shooting up, which is a good thing.
Great.
Right.
Awesome. What do you account for that? How do you account for that?
Well, it's a little hard. Sometimes I think it has to do with how people are generally feeling as far as willingness to spend discretionary income. I think we're poised to take advantage of it in the sense that we have great reviews, and so facing the public, we look like a good option for people that are considering supplementary education. So
awesome.
Again, thanks to your program, I feel like we have the key players in place. So I was able to navigate some challenging conversations, and I had one person that was planning to leave that we really wanted to stay on our team. And so I had a conversation for, creating a pathway for growth and development within our organization in a way that inspired her to stay on. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Congratulations. That's great news. Well done. Well done. Cool. Well, do you want to, since you're chatting, do you want to kick it off? Tell us where you're at, what you want to talk about. I just saw the email. I haven't read it. You want me to read it, or is it easier for you just talk through it a little bit?
Sure. I think what I am realizing out of the work that I've done within your program, kind of looking at, what are the stories that I'm telling myself? How do they impact how I run the business? And I think one that I have is I am fearful of losing players, right? Or so if, for example, if a teacher leaves, we have a certain amount of staff where we can substitute someone in. But if one or two teachers leave who have a lot of students, life gets difficult. We have to scramble. And so I think I have, as a result, been very careful about how I deliver feedback to the point that, in that quadrant where there's a grill up on the upper right-hand side, and I forget the lower left corner. I think I probably find myself there. And at one point you gave me coaching that I can play with being a grill more. So that's what I'm doing. But I think underneath that, there's probably that kind of fear that I'm going to deliver feedback in a way that offends people, and then they'll head out the door and we'll be stuck.
Have you ever delivered feedback to people that they found really offensive? Is that a common experience in your past that as you've given feedback, they go, boy, that's so harsh. It's just overwhelming. And I really can't take that.
I have had instances where the response was surprising, either very defensive. I've had an instance where somebody, it was devastating to my, shocking to me.
Yeah. So would you say that you generally have that experience in life, or would you say those are outliers?
Well, in life,
people experience you as confrontational and historically?
No. I mean, most people say I'm nice.
Ah, okay, great. That's what I needed. Okay. So what that tells me is there is an underlying fear that you're working with that may be even deeper than losing people. And so it is well worth you investigating a little bit. What's your fear? What are you really afraid of? Because here's the deal. If you weren't, and then this would be another question to ask yourself. If I weren't afraid, I would. So if you had no fear at all about people leaving and or whatever underlying fear might also be there. So just to be clear for all of us, we learn our pattern of communicating at a cellular level pre-verbal. You know, our parents teach us. And our parents don't necessarily teach us with words, of course, they teach us with actions. And our response is not simply to do what they do. Our response is either I tend to mimic or I tend to react. So I will either imitate my parent in hopes of getting love, or I will reject and react against what my parent is doing because I believe that it is wrong and dangerous. Or I might react the other way because my parent is so dominating. So I have to be more careful. And if I'm kinder and nicer, sometimes my parent will be more appreciative of me. And so I learn over time how to be either a jerk or a nice guy or a nice girl, right? Like these are the patterns that underlie decades of behaving. And I'm not here trying to suggest that we need to do deep inner childhood work on this call, but it is well worth just asking some questions about what patterns did I develop? And it's okay if you want to provide, you know, some input here and let me know. I'm not saying we can't do that. I just don't want you to feel pressure to go do that work. So, you know, that would be those two questions. So the first one is I'm afraid of people leaving, and that causes me to maybe be a little less direct and a little less urgent in my communication. The thing that I want to flag for you and the importance of doing this work is, you know, I think we've talked about this on this call. When we've ranked ordered bosses, the bosses that are at the top are very direct and honest, but also respectful. The next bosses are jerks. And then the third bosses are nice guys, nice girls. And the reason is because they just feel like they don't know where they stand, right? So I think we've talked about that. So that is, again, my encouragement to keep at this work, because you are more likely to keep people and keep them motivated and keep them engaged when you are direct and respectful. I don't see any risk of you being disrespectful. You know, I work with lots and lots of people, and I know the people that I would say you're at high risk of being disrespectful. We need to work on language coaching. Mm-hmm. For you, my impression of you is that you're likely to package the pill in a giant big ball of cotton candy and hand it to them, and then they'll have no idea what the pill was, that there even was a pill. So great story I had. There was a CEO that I was coaching, and he was notorious for being a nice guy. And I remember I coached him at one point. I said, okay, this is it. You've got a VP who's not performing. You've got to have the hard conversation. I coached him through it. He got all ready for it. He went and had the conversation. Afterwards, I followed up with the VP just to find out how he was feeling. And he's like, yeah, I feel fine. I'm like, oh, great. How'd the conversation go? He goes, went great. Just told me I was doing a great job. And, you know, we talked about some deals that we had to work on. And I don't know why you're asking. And I went back to the CEO. I'm like, how'd that conversation go? Whew, oh boy. I mean, I gave it to him. I went right at him as hard and straight as I know how to go. And I'm sweating a little, but boy, I think I really improved. So it's just a story to show you that it's very, very common that if your habit over time is to be overly kind, when you get direct, for you, it will be experienced as almost shocking. And for them, it'll be experienced as just pretty normal. And the instances that you observed where people were highly reactive or really overwhelmed, I'd call those outliers. I think that has everything to do with who that person is. And really anybody who spoke to them probably would have reacted that way. Mm-hmm. And so I'll just pause there and we'll see what Stephanie recommended in a minute. But let me just pause there and see what your response is to what I'm saying.
So first of all, yeah, I think doing the deep dive, I'm not sure right now if it's useful, but definitely the deep dive in looking at, you know, what may be underlying the tendency to be very careful diplomatic, however you want to say it, and communication would be worth the effort. I think you're probably right. The ones that blew up, I know one was just this hyper perfectionist, and I mean, she's very hard on herself, and
that's so, pretty common. Pretty common. Good. So another thing to go for is to the bonus three, I think it's the Enneagram, or maybe it's two. The Enneagram has huge help in understanding, and kind of it's like a shortcut to understanding why I am the way I am. So people who have a hard time with hard conversations fall into kind of roughly three camps. One is, maybe it's two, but three mostly. One is, the world is overwhelming. Life is overwhelming. There's too much coming at me all the time. And I like to design an inner sanctum that is peaceful. I like the water to be like I can see my reflection in it. I don't like any ripples. And so when I live my life to minimize those ripples so that life isn't so overwhelming. So that's one reason people have a tendency to not engage in hard conversations. Another one is people won't like me. You know, what will people think of me? These are the people that are looking out and sensing what others think of them. They're very, very into social monitoring. What did that comment? How did that affect that person? What happened here? And so they're more like engineering the conversation to maximize being liked, right? So that's a very different motivation than harmony, inner harmony, very different kind of forces at work. And when you understand those forces, you become less governed by them. another one is simply the belief that the world is kind of unsafe, which is different than overwhelming. This is governed more by fear. So if you look at and what they're saying is, it's better for me to stay back, to step away from everybody and everything, because there's a lot of threats out there. And it's better for me to just keep noodling in my mind and trying to figure out all the answers without ever having to engage anything. And so I've just identified three Enneagram types, the underlying motivations of three Enneagram types, all of which are known to be a little bit conflict averse. And so there is an underlying emotion under each of those. The first underlying emotion is actually, if you can believe it, related to anger. It's the world is overwhelming and I want inner harmony. What they're really saying is there's quite a lot of anger that I have about this. I'm frustrated by this, but I'm not even in touch with that anger because that would disrupt the water. So I don't even know my own anger. And because I'm not connected to my own anger, I don't need to have a hard conversation because I'm not motivated to. I'm just happy to be suspending above any discomfort and emotions and staying away from any hard conversations. And that's all related to anger and not dealing with anger. The one about people not liking me is about shame. I'm not worth very much. I need to be worth something. So I'm going to give and help, or I'm going to posture and present. And in both instances, I'm going to get people to validate me, and then I'm going to feel better about myself. So I have underlying shame. And then the last one is underlying fear. And that's I'm just anxious that this is a stressful place and a stressful world, and I need to manage my anxiety. And so all of us have all three emotions at different times at varying degrees, but one of them tends to drive decision-making. And this, by the way, goes for everybody on this call. This isn't just for you, Ed, but you know, that it's well worth asking if you are a person who tends to be averse to conflict. These are some underlying indicators. And, you know, I would say that David and Stephanie, I know you guys a little bit, and I would say you might fall into this category. It's clearly Stephanie's been reading books about it, so I know she feels that. Michelle, obviously you have the opposite. you have an eagerness to jump into hard conversations. And Laura, I actually don't know you well enough yet to know. You've been out of pocket, so we're glad to have you back. So I'm not sure. But I'd love to have each of you just weigh in briefly about that, what I just observed, and tell me how you interact with this tendency to avoid hard conversations. Did I map you each relatively accurate? 100% fall in the category, specifically first and second. Okay, cool. David?
Oh, go ahead.
I would say absolutely, you know, head on. And I tend to try to avoid conflict and thence the difficult conversations. You know, part of it, you know, I like to rationalize it's because I'm not prepared. I don't have the right tools to do my job. I'm afraid of having a bad outcome. Therefore, no outcome is better than a bad outcome. And that's how I've kind of rationalized skirting around some of these topics.
Okay, good. So what you just described would be falling really well into that category of anxiety, which is preparation, over-preparation, gathering all the information before you ever have to act, right? So that's the opposite of what Michelle lives with. Michelle lives with a desire to say, hey, this is wrong. I need to confront that. I'm not okay with that. And you're like, I'm cool with it not being okay for a while. You know, let me just gather information. So that's great. Laura.
I'm somewhere in between. I used to be pretty conflict averse. I still suffer from these kinds of things you were talking about from childhood, but I've gotten pretty good at having difficult conversations, and I actually enjoy it now. I enjoy like mediating and initiating those things, but it depends on the person. I'm still learning people's motivations. I'm kind of learning to take things less personally and realize that it's all about whatever their personality or bias or background is. And so I'm starting to see other people's anxieties and difficulties where I didn't used to be able to see those. And I can see why they're acting the way they are, like basically how that's driving that. And it makes it a lot easier. Doesn't mean that they're easy to deal with, but they're easier to deal with.
Yes. Well, and you may or may not, this may not be like an area of challenge. There are certain types and people that hard conversations are not a real area of challenge, meaning you can have them. It's not a big deal. You don't go searching for them, but it's not overly problematic.
It's been a challenge for me. It's just not as much as it used to be.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And Stephanie, sounds like you've made some progress as well. Do you want to speak to your experience of the progress you've made?
Yeah. That inner child work really helped me identify what those things were I needed to confront. And the good girl, nice girl kind of, you know, decades of seeking approval from people outside of me. I'm an only child. And I think, and that kind of achiever type where I found value in achievement. So when I got good grades, when I got gold stars from my teacher, when my parents rewarded me for my report card or, you know, athletic accolades, that those kinds of things kind of built my identity. And the nice girl, good girl, please, thank you kind of way of carrying myself. I'm still trying to understand what it was about my environment that made me feel that was the safe way to move about the environment. But that was certainly part of me understanding why I am the way I am and why I struggle with those conversations with people or that confrontation because I do want people to like me. And at the same time, you know, I also learning about boundaries am not willing to create space for disrespect either. So that's what kind of led me to those books. And they have some really good just kind of tactical things and strategies that you can employ to kind of help you navigate those conversations. But it all went back to once I realized that the whole good girl identity was really what was contributing to all those little betrayals of myself, maybe not showing up fully authentically because I was, you know, I feared judgment. And, you know, fear of judgment behind death is the number one fear that we as humans share. So it's one of those, you know, just identifying that and where it came from really helped me kind of problem solve once I knew what the problem was.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. There's also just an element of we come this way in the world. Sometimes it isn't even, I mean, some of it is parents and how we got formed, and for sure, as we were talking about child stuff. But also, you know, my brother came into the world with the same largely environment I had, and he is the opposite of me. So he adapted to the same environment using different techniques and strategies than I used. And so that's the other thing that makes us unique is sometimes we just come into the world this way, and this is the lessons we have to learn. So appreciate that. Michelle, do you have any advice for those of us that are averse to hard conversations? Overall, what I love and respect about Michelle and people who have Michelle's gift is that they have an abundance of emotional courage. And it's something that I really respect and admire. And in a way, dealing with someone who has a lot of emotional courage is a much easier person to coach, because it's literally just like, here's a couple words to use instead of those other words you want to use. And they end up being really, really effective. Whereas those of us that are learning to have more emotional courage to actually have the conversation, it's more than just language coaching. It's often inner work. So Michelle, any advice you have to the rest of us who are, since this is more your strength?
I'm not sure what you're trying to say there, Shane. Anyways, I mean, basically what you just said, right?
It's I just want you to like me, so I'm trying to say a nice thing. I don't want you to be mad at me.
I've hung around this long. I'd like you. For me, I call it learning grace under fire. So it's having those proper words, because like you said, I don't tolerate the disrespect, and I don't tolerate the, hey, this might be wrong. I have those boundaries that are so driven that it's learning how to, you know, it's okay if someone did this, and it's okay if something like I don't have to approach every single one, but when, I don't know if I'm making sense, but when I do need to, learning to have more grace under fire. But it was also for me dealing with some of the things, as you know, in my childhood, mm-hmm. and things I'm still dealing with from my childhood that I was thought was over, and Jane nicely pointed out maybe not. So anyways, you know, but it's just, I think every interaction for me, I overanalyze though, Shane, at the same time. Like, I want people still to like me, and I want people still to be able to come in and see me as approachable. And I still want all those things everybody else wants. So when something doesn't, I'm like, okay, I analyze every single situation. Okay, maybe I should have said that, but did this happen? So I do a lot of that too.
Sure. Yeah. And I'm not saying that we've all got it perfected, any of us, but it is to say there is a hierarchy of needs. And so on your hierarchy of needs, justice might be higher than being liked. So while you have the need to be liked, you might be like, I'm okay if they don't like me, I'm going to say it, you know?
It depends, but I've also learned that I don't always have to say something all the time.
Very true.
And that if I just sit back and watch, generally they're the ones that look like the fool and I don't.
Got it. Great. Okay, thanks for that. Ed, did we get at some of the things you wanted to ask about? I didn't mean to kind of...
Yeah, we did. Thank you. I was just saying, of those three elements that you listed, I can see myself to some extent in all three, but I think the one that really resonated with me was the first one. I have a meditation practice, and it is really useful for me, to the degree that I do it every day, and I'm not always disciplined, but just to turn off the mind and separate from the overwhelm, if you will, or the stimulus of stuff that comes at me at work. You know, being a very small company, there's just lots of different things happening, and different hats to wear and different ways to address things. So it could be that is the predominant thing that underlies my approach and, you know, reluctance to have hard conversations. And indeed, I do find myself sometimes getting, it's unexpressed to other people, but I have just anger, you know, if I reflect on, you know, what's going on, it's like borderline rant, really, just.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, so, good. Well, it's good awareness. Here's what I'm going to suggest you do. I want you to start watching some of the Enneagram videos, and particularly the Enneagram 9. I think you'll find a lot of resonance there.
Yeah. I had a friend that was into the Enneagram, and she said I was a 9 or one other, you know, that or one other one. But
yeah, most you got a lot of 9, what I'll call energy. And a big part of the work of a 9 is, you know, you sitting on a lily pad meditating for hours is heaven for most 9s. It's wonderful. And it's because it gets you that inner sanctum. But moving to act is the area for the 9. And by the way, the person I was coaching that I referenced was also a 9. When he said, boy, I really gave it to him, the other person was like, wow, it was really friendly and kind and sweet. And I don't know what you're talking about. So really kind of practicing what it means to write down an objective, a goal, an agenda, something, and then really committing to act, moving your kind of awareness into action will help you immensely. And you'll be experienced as more credible, and you might even have less anger. And I think it makes a lot of sense. So
very good. Thank you much.
Yeah, you bet. Keep playing with that. Okay, David, you had sent me an email as well. Do you want to open up what you're wanting to talk about?
Yeah, so to summarize the situation, physician, I'm in the operating room a lot. This didn't affect me directly, but it does affect me indirectly. And from the standpoint of I've in my inner sanctum, I don't feel like I can stand by and do nothing or say nothing, but an incident where a physician in the operating room is being very disrespectful of the rest of the operating room staff, raising their voice and cursing, and even to the point of, you know, throwing drapes and papers at people. So for whatever reason, they were having a bad day. And the way it escalated was that one of the nurses who I've known for 20 years resigned and left because I don't need this. I don't have to do this. I'm not going to do it. And, you know, I think part of our bodies and people, you know, for the past 2 years, they've been living under a lot more stress, and therefore maybe she had all she could stand. And that was like the breaking point. So for, you know, I wasn't there, it didn't affect me directly, but indirectly it does, because this is a very, very good nurse that the institution should have done more to intervene. And from what I've heard, you know, I didn't interview the doctor, I didn't interview the people that were there. And I've heard this secondhand, and just knowing this person, I know if something had to have been bad for her to make this step. And so part of me feels like I should get involved and find out, because I know that the institution made no reprimands towards the doctor. The people that were there, I did hear that they kind of said, well, you know, that's between the nurse and the doctor to work it out. Well, that didn't work out at all. It was kind of really just, you know, one person leaving. And so I guess part of me feels like I should get involved, because the person who's the chief of surgery is kind of one of those categories of a jerk, and not really, you know, he has a thankless job. He doesn't get paid to be the chief. And, you know, these are conversations that are difficult, and I'm sure he probably didn't want to get involved with it. But I think without any dialogue to find out what the details were, or to discuss with the doctor that caused the commotion, that, hey, this isn't behavior that should be tolerated, and to not do anything in a way kind of subliminally reinforces it. Hey, this is fine to be like this.
Okay. So
my wife says, it's not your fight to fight, stay out of it. You got enough to on your plate, but I just feel like I can't sit by and do nothing.
So what, I'm unclear what the relationship is to this institution. So you have your own business as a surgeon.
Right. And so I go to the hospital and I do surgery in the hospital. So this is the hospital.
Right.
And the nurse works for the hospital.
Got it.
Other doctors come in and they use the operating room to do their procedures. But they're not employed by the hospital. So the hospital employs the nurses and the scrub techs. The surgeon is not employed by the hospital.
Okay. So he's another version of you, basically.
Yes.
Okay. And so you feel a desire to protect and defend the nurse and what happened to her, right?
To do that, and also to reinforce and send the message that this is not the type of behavior anybody should be displaying. I mean, I hold physicians at a high pedestal, that they should be a role model. And this is not a role model to have that kind of behavior. And, you know, I don't care if you've had a bad day, you still have to be professional about it. So I feel like they kind of failed at that. And I kind of got the vibe that nobody wanted to get involved. Nobody wanted to do anything other than throw up their hands and say, what do you want us to do?
Okay. So I think you have pretty limited authority here. And effectively, I think all you can do is lodge a complaint, which is fine. But I don't think there's much more you can do than that unless you have leverage of some kind. It strikes me that you are a person who is using facilities provided by a hospital, and they allow you to do that. And there's some financial arrangement that benefits everybody. And so that's that, right? So, I mean, a question I would have for you is, what leverage do you think you might have in order to be effective in this situation?
You know, so, you know, they have a limited staff, and this was like one of their best nurses, and now they have one less nurse. And so now they've always been a little short staff. So they lost a nurse.
Okay.
If I wanted to play hardball, I could say, well, you know, guys, if you don't want good nurses, maybe you don't want good doctors, and maybe I'll say goodbye to you as well. And you know, that would be a potential option, although it's one of those things where, you know, I do a lot, about 70% of my business at that hospital. I have another place I go to as well, but I would have to kind of rearrange my work habits to make that happen. And so I don't know if that's a statement I want to do if I don't follow through with it, because it would be harder for me to do that. And, you know, so I do feel like, you know, something should be said, at the least, you know, a verbal reprimand, and, you know, letting everybody else know that, hey, this is not a behavior that's tolerated. And honestly, you know, I'm not the person in position, but I would say, you know, as a doctor to doctor, so you realize you ran off one of our best nurses, and I don't think I think you need to analyze how you're treating people.
I think it's fine for you to have conversations with the doctor or anybody else you want to talk to and express your frustration and let them know you'd like to see something different. I think as far as your commitment to executing on a threat, you just want to examine, what are you really committed to? You know, because the reality is, we suffer for anything we're committed to. We are willing to suffer for that which we're committed to. And so this sounds like it's going to cause a little bit of suffering for you, and you need to figure out, how committed are you to that? And you may be committed to it, and you may want to execute that. So it's not so much that I'm saying you should or shouldn't. It's more just make sure you're really investigating where you are, and that it's not just from a place of emotional reaction, but a genuine, like, no, this is a violation and a commitment that I have to myself. And so, this is what's got to happen going forward. So, so that's my suggestion to you. I think I understand your wife doesn't want you to get distracted and put more energy into that. That's a conversation that really only you get to decide, is do I want to spend my energy and emotional capital this way? And I think you have several steps you can take, one of which is you can have a couple of hard conversations. Great way to practice the hard conversations training. You know, you can go in there and you can initiate two hard conversations, one with hospital administration, one with the surgeon, and see what reaction you get. And that may then help you know what the next gate is that you've got to pass through and decide, right? So it's a stage gate process. Pass through this gate, you enter this stage. You can't figure out this next gate until you're in this stage. Then you pass through that gate and you'll make a new decision, and that'll enter a new stage. So those would be just some observations that I have.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Can I ask a couple questions?
Sure. Yeah.
How many years did this nurse work with that particular doctor?
I would guess about 5 years at least. The nurse has been around for at least 20 years that I've known. The physician has been on staff at least 5 years.
Okay. So that's one thing to remember. She knew what she was up against. And she just reached that point of she'd had enough, which I don't blame her. I had something similar with colleagues who left, who really should have been retained. And I felt much better after I voiced my displeasure with that to basically our equivalent of HR. You know, there was nothing to be done about it at that point, but I was just like, you know, it makes me and my other colleagues feel bad. It makes us question, you know, this company when things like that happen and or are allowed to happen. And they agreed. And I just felt so much better after having that conversation. So you're not going to be able to fix it. But I think talking to somebody, talking to administration or talking to the surgeon directly, you may feel much better afterwards. Just even if you get a negative reaction, you gave it the old college try. And I know you're in a very different situation than I was in, but you also have more pull than I had.
Very good.
Yep. Okay, we're going to move on to Stephanie. Welcome back. It's been a couple weeks. I don't think we've had you on.
Yeah, it's been a it's been a whirlwind, and Wednesdays are tough. So I'm glad I'm able to join today.
Yeah. What's been going on? I mean, last we talked, and I can't see you. If you want to turn your camera on, I'd love to see you. Last we talked, you were kind of
multitasking.
Yeah. last we talked, you were kind of thinking maybe you were going to leave the company. So what ended up happening with that?
You know, I'm still there. I'm in round 4 of a marketing VP interview for a marketing VP role at another company.
Okay.
And, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure even if I get the offer that I want to take the offer. I think internally what I've had to confront and get really real on is I'm not following or taking the risk or having that emotional courage to do what I actually want to do, which is pursue my own entrepreneurial endeavors and not rely on a company and the stability. And, you know, I feel like I look back and I reflect and I've chosen the path of stability, and I've said no to things that maybe weren't as stable or weren't thought of as career paths that would result in anything. And so out of safety, I went and, you know, went into business instead of sports journalism. Like, it's just, it's, you know, but then it's like my passion really it's not where I am. And I'm just looking for answers outside of me and outside of the company that even if I find that, I don't think that's truly what I want. So I'm just kind of, where I am in that journey is just confronting what I really want ultimately and, you know, what kind of action and risks. And if I'm committed to that, how much, you know, suffering, compromise, sacrifice am I willing in order to follow through with that commitment?
Okay. Big.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you already know what it is you would do if you weren't afraid?
Yeah. I have, you know, one of the things is narrowing my focus and where to start because there's so much. If you saw an image of the inside of my brain, you'd see like all these open browser tabs where there's just so much going on in there. It's about distilling it and really refining and, you know, fine tuning what that ultimate vision looks like. And I'm working through that. And I also, one of my challenges is motivation isn't always going to be there. So when it's not there, I'll take inspired action when I'm inspired and I'll, you know, go in spurts and do all these things and all this research and, you know, put together all these plans. And then I kind of set it down and don't pick it back up until I'm feeling inspired again. And that lack of committed action isn't going to get me where I want to go. So I invested in some accountability coaching, and I'm just trying that out, but it really helped so far, just kind of teasing out what those three clear actionables that you can do this week, and what do you want to have completed by the end of the month, and what would you like to have accomplished in 6 months and 1 year, and just kind of backing into very digestible things, because I have a tendency to get very overwhelmed, and I get paralyzed by it, because that perfectionism, that all or nothing kind of mentality leaves me going, you know, it's like analysis paralysis, and it's literally paralyzing. And it's almost like it leads to things like procrastination and just other stressors that kind of begin to just compound on each other. And it's, you know, not worth the avoiding of the pain to actually power through it, because there's even more energy spent on analyzing it and stewing in it and wrestling with it and feeling out of alignment with what you're actually, the purpose you're supposed to be filling. And that's where a lot of my struggle lies, and I'm unpacking it.
Okay. So you already know what it is you're wanting to create.
Yeah.
What is that?
There's a lot. That is the things that have helped me kind of refine it, or what are the things that I really value? Community is something I really value. Inclusivity is something I really value, and evolution is something I really value. And those things I feel are kind of the common thread that tie all the business ideas together. I have about a decade of experience marketing, digital marketing and e-commerce, and I know how to make money online. And I think that's something, especially heading into a potential recession, that people are probably, high demand skill. And so I want to package that in a way that can help and empower people to, you know, pursue their own entrepreneurial endeavors using digital marketing strategies and tips and you know, frameworks and that kind of thing. So that would be in the form of, you know, an online course, group sessions like this, some kind of, you know, 5-step process or 6-step process that can help at least get people, you know, give them a roadmap for what that looks like and where to even start. Because there's a ton. And a lot of times I think people are overwhelmed by it. You know, do I TikTok? Do I Instagram? Do I, you know, write blogs? Do I do paid advertising? Like, where do I start? So I think I can package that in a digestible way for people. So that's one, but that's not what I'm really like super passionate about. I'm passionate about the outcome it can drive and the empowerment that it gives. And, you know, when I see students' faces light up, like that's what like makes me happy. It's the marketing part of it is kind of, you know? And then I would also like to have build a community of like-minded people who are on that journey of healing and evolution and, you know, self-discovery and, you know, fulfilling that hierarchy of needs and reaching that kind of evolved highest self kind of state. And I think when you're surrounded by people like this group who share those similar interests and prioritize those things, that, you know, we can help each other by building that community achieve that. So that would also be in the form of some kind of digital course, as well as group sessions. So those are kind of two paths.
All right.
And then a skincare line and all these other things, but we'll start there.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you already know all this, but I'm going to suggest playing with focus as your most important next step. And I would encourage whatever your greatest excitement is, rather than the thing that you think could work. Because entering that world will take a lot. It's a huge undertaking. And it's a beautiful one. Mm-hmm. But you want to make sure that you're engaging the things that you're most aligned with in your passions. And so based on everything you just told me, I'll just mirror back, and anybody else is welcome to mirror back as well. The one that you seem to light up the most at was the last one you said, not the skincare line, but the transformational piece, which I would consider like life coaching kind of a thing, right?
Yeah, right.
That's the one that seems to light up the most. And you use the phrase inspired action. And again, I'm not saying you need to do what I'm saying. I'm just giving you feedback, my experience of you, right? So that's the thing that I heard light up. The second thing I would say is there's inspired action, which is awesome. I'm a big fan of. I tend to advise people on that. There's also the other word that I know you know. It's called imperfect action.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's the best one there is. It's actually more important than any kind of action there is. It's imperfect action. And you've probably heard phrases like this before, but iterate your way to awesome. You know, it's iterative little decisions. And so the more you go, my encouragement to you is get really, really good at imperfect action. And in general, as weird as it sounds, faster and less perfect is better. In entrepreneurial land, speed is your friend, and getting things out there. So those are going to be inner skills that you'll have to learn that are not something you were trained for or rewarded in as an employee of a company. As an employee of a company, you're rewarded for really good, effective action. And your pay is related to your effective action that you keep taking. In entrepreneurial land, your pay is related to how fast you can iterate, how quickly you can move to an imperfect act. And so the metaphor is, of course, it takes a crane in order to turn the direction of a dump truck if it's sitting still. But if it's moving, all it takes is the steering wheel. And so that's what perfect action
is. Wow, that's a good one.
It's just movement forward, and it's celebrate how imperfect it is and celebrate that it happened. So you go, wow, that was the worst headline I've ever written, and it's out there in the world now. Now I'm gonna write a new one. Now I'm gonna draft a new one because that one isn't getting any response. So I'm gonna do another one. And I'm gonna have 38,000 headlines I'm gonna write over the course of my lifetime because every one of them is just impacting that iteration process. The other thing is, in entrepreneurial land, there is no such thing as failure, only learning, right?
Lessons, right?
but this is important, and you know this as a digital marketer, because you know how critical it is to capture all the data that showed you that something didn't work.
Yeah.
All the things that didn't work are crucial to log and remember and understand so that you can never do that again, right? In digital marketing, that's a critical part of the practice, the art. So you have a leg up there. Yeah. You have a leg up there. So anyway, this is not my primary domain. My primary domain is elsewhere, but as an entrepreneur myself, who's done the very thing you want to do, I'm just giving you a few lessons that I learned along the way. And for sure, that's why I would say I paid attention to the thing that lit you up, because, and the reason this is so important, what lights you up is you're going to spend a great deal of time doing things that don't light you up in order to be able to do the thing that lights you up. So if you spend all of this time, effort, and energy to build a digital marketing consulting agency, and you're like, I don't even really like doing this. Now you've just spent all your time doing a bunch of things you don't like to do something you don't like. Right. So you're going to need to learn to do the thing that you love. And that love of that thing is going to drive you to do all the things that you don't want to do. Because you're connected to that sense of purpose and outcome. So.
Thank you. Thank you for that reminder. Thank you for that. As a one who struggles with that perfectionism thorn in the side, is that's been probably one of the biggest life lessons that's going to help me just get unstuck.
That is right. And just the passion, reconnecting to the passion and keep moving. Okay. So sounds like right now your biggest thing is not around leadership management, how to figure out which company it's really
about. It totally is. I'm like, in the meantime, I'm just, you know, hanging on and trying to maintain a positive outlook. And, you know, a couple few calls ago when you're like, you've got some resentment, or you said something about having resentment for my leader. And it's just, I think it took a long time to even, it's almost like discovering Santa Claus isn't real. I think I looked up to him for so long, for so many years, that I couldn't even bear the thought of even having resentment for him, you know? And like you being able to parse that out, it just kind of like, yeah, I do.
Yes, we do. So, yeah. So and I might suggest that you are, this may be the way that you have to go, but I just want you to be prepared for this possibility. And that is, sometimes the universe will kick you out of the nest if you're not willing to fly on your own. And I am observing in you potential unconscious behaviors that could bring that about.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, an unconscious behavior is hiding from yourself how resentful you are to your boss. Mm-hmm. And another unconscious behavior is looking for jobs and interviewing even when you know you don't even want that job. Yeah. And that means that you're finding your way out of a boat, but you haven't committed which way you want to go. And the beautiful thing is, if you're meant to go, the universe will find a way to get you out.
Mm-hmm.
You may not like the way it happens.
I always wonder, because he's someone who doesn't have the direct conversations. I don't think we've had one direct conversation in the last decade. And I'm curious about, okay, perhaps he wants to push me out of the nest because he's finding that we see things too differently, or we're not in alignment with each other. And, you know, I'm prepared. I don't know whether I'm prepared, but I've mentally gone, okay, if there's a day where I walk in and my stuff is in a box, like, are you going to be attached to this, or are you going to be okay with that? And so, I don't know. I've thought about that too, but knowing him, I don't know if he would actually have the courage to do something like that, but I've thought about it. It's been a little bit, we've been distant. He hasn't quite communicated with me very much. And every communication we have, I initiate. So it's an early indicator
of a shift that's taking place. And he undoubtedly, whether he knows it or not, is sensing the shift that's already happened in you. Mm-hmm. And so all I'm doing is naming for you some things that are on the horizon that may or may not come to pass, but the more you can become conscious of what's really going on in you, mm-hmm. greater agency you'll have in that transition.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Such as
the number two guy, interestingly, is also having the same, he's been having dreams about getting fired and just, you know, we're both a little bit on, like, a little bit on edge.
It may not even be that you get fired there. It's not that that's the only way. It's more like, you know, I just from personal experience, I unconsciously brought about the end of my career. And looking back, I can see how I needed that desperately. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know how to do it. I didn't have the courage to do it. So I kind of had to, like, create the scenario in very unconscious ways to force their hand, instead of just going in with courage and saying, here's how much longer you have me for. I'm going to give everything for the next year. You'll have everything you need from me. You got 1 year with me. I'm going to give you everything. At the end of that year, I'm going to do this. And let's just plan accordingly. Let's just have an agreement and a commitment that, assuming everything is going well and I'm performing, that this is, or 6 months, maybe it's not a year, right? Mm-hmm. It's whatever, mm-hmm. whatever amount of time you want to give to say, hey, I respect, this is what's gone on. My heart isn't in it anymore. I'm not aligned with this. We need to start together talking through how to plan my departure in a way that really does helps the organization, helps you, and helps me. And so mm-hmm. here's what I need. I need X, Y, and Z. you tell me what you need, and then let's come to an agreement and let's have a really good ending. Let's land the plane in a really beautiful way.
Mm-hmm. So you too got a message from your universe. Also, gave
You don't get into this kind of work because you're just got spare time. You have nothing better to do. You do it because you feel called. Mm-hmm. You feel a sense of purpose guiding you into something, and you're getting all kinds of warning signs.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognize them. I'm familiar with them. So I'm just giving you
means the answer. a lot coming from somebody who's, you know, on the other side of it. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So keep playing and see what happens and keep learning. So
I will. Good. Thank you.
All right. Looks like David had to go. Anybody else want to comment? Anything else anybody wants to share or say? Questions?
I just put mine in the chat. Stephanie, I don't know if you can see the chat.
I want to hear it. I just read it. Tell us.
Oh, well, so I was a CFO. I don't even know how to characterize my former boss, but he was very toxic to work for. I would handle things very differently now than I did then, but I don't think there was any winning in that scenario. And I even knew that going into it, but I thought I could handle him. But yeah, it was just one thing too many. And I, like, before I even realized what I was saying, I said, you need to start looking for my replacement. And that was that. And it was the best thing I ever did. And I worked like a really crappy job for a little while after that, cause I didn't have anything planned. But I was so happy doing that crappy job and not working for him. But it did, the stuffing everything for the year or so that I worked for him. It took me a couple of years to recover from that job. I had to take a much better, but still way beneath my abilities job while I recovered from that. And I didn't even realize what I was doing, but that is what ended up happening. And now I've been able to step into a bigger, better role, but it's still not where I was at before. So you pay a very high price for continuing in that kind of situation. And like Shane is saying, you're going to get out of it one way or another, whether it's you losing your temper and resigning. You know, I gave notice. I actually stayed for a good month and helped train my replacement, but that train has already started moving, it sounds like. And it's a scary as hell thing, but it's not a bad thing, because I'm the happiest I've ever been.
Oops. Words and testimony I needed to hear. Thank you for sharing. I've thought about going off and getting a serving job. You know, I went through college in the restaurant. Hey. I'm like, fascinated, you know, because you just have that mental space when you leave, even if whoever you had to deal with, but it's a different kind of, you know, it's a different kind of energy you put out there. And then I don't think I will, but.
Here's the other thing to just be aware of is like, the part of the reason I'm not afraid of the recession everyone's talking about is because the last recession we had was 2008. And in 2008, we didn't have this.
Right.
And that has enabled a vast economy that doesn't really pay attention to the markets. So Turo, Uber Eats, Uber, Lyft, all these different things that can turn you into gig economy that is even easier than waiting tables. You can turn your car into a rental service to make the payments and go out and buy another car, and they will pay for themselves and then some. You know, it takes limited amount of resources, limited amount of research, and you have an ability to make income in the most strange ways. And so that's the other thing I would just say is, you know, that used to be, I lost my job, I'm out of luck. There's nothing I can do. I'm knocking on doors hoping someone will hire me. I got to start a whole business from scratch. I don't even know where to start or how to do it. That world is gone. Like, you can engage that world if you want, but you also have this other vast world of a gig economy that can be piece together into an actual living while you follow your passion. You know, so there are lots and lots of ways to make this happen.
There's money everywhere to be made.
Absolutely.
It's out there. Abundance. It's all there. It's just out there for the taking.
Yeah. And I, that's right. That the philosophy is right. I'm just saying it's never been easier just tactically. Just even if you don't have a mindset of abundance, it's just right there. And that was not the case before. There was a lot of trust that was required before, a lot of faith, a lot of anxiety. When my dad lost his job in the 80s, he was 3 years without a job. It was a recession. He ended up delivering papers, you know, as a 50-year-old man. He's delivering papers. That we don't have to do that. It's an amazing shift that's taken place.
Agreed.
Okay, what else? Anybody else have anything they want to check in on?
Anybody? I guess, so I just assumed a new position on June 1st, and a big part of my job is having difficult conversations. I have to be the go-between between at least three different groups of people who have different agendas, even within the groups, lots of strong personalities, different agendas. And I like that. It's kind of like, I didn't realize how much it's my dream job. We'll find out if I say that once I get further into it. But I'm taking over from somebody who's been doing it for, I don't know, 10, 15 years. And he's having a hard time letting go. Like those people are actually in town right now. They're in the office and they're having face-to-face meetings with them. And I really should be part of that, but he's having that like fear of letting go. And he and I talked about it briefly yesterday, but I guess I kind of want your feedback on like, I'm just letting it be. There's plenty of other stuff for me to do and learn in the meanwhile, because I'm still finishing out my tasks from my old job and learning all about the new job. But how do I get him to that point? He told me he thinks it's going to take him like being sick or having a sick family member or something, like not being able to run one of those meetings to turn the reins over to me. Because that is the goal, is for me to take over all of that.
Is he your boss?
Yeah. And so once he does that, he said, once he does that and hears I did a great job, he'll probably be totally cool with it. But should we baby step into that? Like, should I propose that? Because I can tell he has like the goal he gave me yesterday was for me to be running those meetings like by August or September, which is pretty soon. I mean, I'm ready to do it now, but I do learn a lot from watching how he navigates these waters. So I'm also happy just to wait. But should I take it personally that he doesn't have me in these face-to-face meetings right now? I kind of see it as
I don't think you need to take it personally. I don't think you need to take it personally, but you do need to start asserting yourself. And I would say you guys have to form an agreement that you expect you'll each honor. And so that is, you know, assuming you, for example, if you are accountable for certain things, but you don't have the authority or responsibility over those things, then you're not going to be able to do your job.
Right.
So if running those meetings and having those one-on-ones directly impacts what you're accountable for, then you've got to have that conversation with him.
Okay. And if he's
doing it for you, you can simply say, I'm not sure you need me. And I didn't sign up for this role. And if you don't need me, if you just need an assistant or something, that's fine. That's not what I'm here for.
Right.
So just reminding him what the original agreement was. And if he's saying to you, there's the only thing stopping you from doing your job is me and my just feelings about it. Over time, that isn't a valid data input. Like for lack of a better word, it's like, I appreciate how you feel. That must be very difficult. We're actually talking about our agreements for how we're going to operate, not how we feel about what we're doing.
Right. Okay.
So, in a way, what I'm doing is I'm telling you to do the opposite of what I often tell leaders to do, which is pay attention to how people feel. In this instance, he's allowing the feeling he has about it to govern how he's going to behave instead of understanding we're making agreements. And that's what agreements are. Agreements are, regardless of how you feel about it, you had a conscious choice. You made a choice, and the choice was to enter this agreement. If you enter the agreement, we will expect each other to honor the behaviors of that agreement.
Okay.
And if you can't seem to respect those behaviors, then we need to either retrade the agreement or I need to form a new agreement elsewhere, right? Like those are that's the sequence of steps. So I don't know that and I would absolutely say, hey, having those meetings, maybe it's just habit, but that is going to erode my credibility and my ability to do my job. So this is really critical. The first, you know, it'd be worth you, if you have a new role, go look at that first 90-day success plan. Bonus number one in the modules, it is so powerful and important to understand how those first 90 days play out. That if he sidelines you that whole time, so I'll back up and state it this way. The first 90 days, you have a new role, even in an existing organization, even with all the same constellation of relationships, the moment you have a new role, the clock restarts. And the clock restarts in a very specific way. You are granted 100% credibility on day one. Everybody goes, you've been hired. I mean, unless there's bad eggs in the mix, but for the most part, anytime you come in, it's, hey, we trust you. You're the winner. Go. If every word you speak and every decision you make will impact your credibility, whether it rises or falls in those first 90 days, for the rest of your career, it does.
Okay, you're starting to stress me out, Shane.
No, this is important. This is important. That's why
I know, but I'm stressing because I'm 3 weeks in now and I haven't been operating that way.
That's okay. That's why I want you to watch that training and I want you to develop a strategy for the next 90 days. 3 weeks is fine. I mean, 90 days is a rough, right? It's not like there's a hard stop. It's 90 to 120 days, somewhere in there. You've got a time frame. If you go a year, it's too long, right?
So yeah, we're not doing that.
Right. So what I'm saying is the first 90 days, if you lose credibility because he messed something up, by the way, your boss can be the one to cause you to lose credibility. You can do everything right and your boss can mess it up. I entered a role where my boss screwed everything up. I lost all the credibility in the first 90 days. It took me 2 years to get it back because my boss didn't understand it. And I didn't understand it either. I was just like, well, okay, he's the boss. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Now, if a boss came to me and was like, here's what I'm thinking of doing, I'd just be like, nope, we're not doing that. It's a huge mistake. You're going to set me up for failure. You're not going to like that. I'm not going to like that. Here's what needs to happen. Because he just has never done it. He doesn't know. So the point is, what happens is if you lose that credibility in 90 days, it's very hard to get it back. If you maintain it, it's very hard to lose later. So that's the goal. Okay. The goal is, how do I maximize credibility? So I'll give you a quick example. When I started with this new role, I was formerly a megachurch pastor and I was a big deal in that little subculture. And then I became a chief leadership officer of a real estate development company. And that job was my dream job. I had no direct reports. I had no formal P&L responsibility. My job was to go in and do culture and coaching and all these different things, which was amazing. And I got to learn a lot of the things that I teach now. He was a friend of mine from college. We hadn't been in touch in 15 years. They did not open the position for interviews. He just hired me and made me a partner in the business. So I got a piece of the profits day one because I was an author and a public speaker and a public figure that he was really feeling lucky to have me. Well, that's really great and all fine. But in the world of employees, they're like, who is this guy? He has no real estate experience. He's friends with the CEO. They didn't interview anybody. What if I wanted that job? I would like a chance at bat. You didn't give me a chance at bat. And now you come in here and you have no real hard work you have to do. Like I got to do every single day. That was three strikes against me. And basically every single one of the leaders had to leave the company and we had to hire new leaders before everybody then finally saw the validity of what I was bringing. Because I transformed the organization in very real ways, but everybody was just like, no, I resent you and hate you because the CEO brought you in all the wrong ways. No one said that, of course. It's just the underlying. So I'm not saying that's your scenario, but I want you to be thinking through and hard about what decisions is he making and how is that setting Laura up for how she'll be viewed or experienced or trusted going forward.
Yeah. And because so what happened was there's only four of us in this department, my boss, me, and another peer and an assistant. And the assistant had asked my boss if she or I were needed in these meetings that are happening right now. And he had said no. But I was looking at his calendar and I'm just like, I should really be in this meetings. I mean, this is meeting face to face with all of the players. And it happens every quarter. And so I'll do the next quarterly meeting, but I'm not doing this one, and it's on site. And so I asked him, he also has, I don't want to digress too much, but his wife has a potentially terminal illness. He's been in and out helping with that. So he's been spread very thin. And this is a very efficient, good communicator, but he hasn't had any time. We met face-to-face one-on-one yesterday for the first time. And it was to go over my transition plan, and it was great. But he's just kind of like flying by the seat of his pants. But I did ask him Monday morning, first thing, I was like, do I need to be in these meetings? And he said, not yet. He said, not this time. And so I said, okay, but my former boss's boss had said to me, I don't know if it was the day before or that day, he was just like, I'm not sure why Russ didn't put you in these meetings. I mean, this is the perfect opportunity to introduce you to all of the players. And so that kind of confirmed what I was feeling, is like, why am I not in these meetings? So yeah, I got to sort that out with him.
Yeah, I think start watching or reviewing the first 90 days success plan.
Okay.
Develop a strategy that you're going to present to your boss, because he doesn't know how to onboard you. He has no idea.
He doesn't. This is scary stuff for him.
Right. And you've also identified an external factor that's going to influence his decision making. So yeah. What you've got to be able to do is got to go to him and say, here's my plan. I need you to approve that plan. Yes, you can do that plan. Great. Here's what I need in order to achieve that plan. I need access to this. I need to be in these situations. And here's why that's so important for you and for me.
Okay.
For me to be successful, I need to be seen as credible and trusted. For that to happen, I have to be in conversations as soon as humanly possible. Okay. It's the only way that we're going to get to this goal that we have an agreement around. So you're forming agreements with your boss and you're designing a strategy for you to be really effective. Now, some of the stuff in the first 90 days plan is going to be overkill. You won't need to do it. Use your intuition. You'll be guided through it. You'll know, like, okay, I don't need to worry about that. If you have questions, come back to me next week and we'll talk through, like, yes, that sounds great. Maybe next week, come to me with the plan. Then just tell me, here's what I'm thinking I need to do. I watch the videos, or you can read the guidebook. Okay. Right? You don't even have to watch the videos if you don't want. There's more in there, but the guidebook is a great place to start. And then you can use the videos to go deeper. Then come back to me next week and we'll talk about how is that relevant for what you need to do specifically. Sound good?
Okay. Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm glad you raised that. That's really important. I didn't know you were in a new role.
Yeah, so. It happened pretty fast.
Good. Well, congratulations. That's exciting. And it sounds like you're going to be great at it. So we'll look forward to hearing more. Awesome. Okay. Anybody else want to give feedback, input, or talk about anything they're dealing with?
I'm going to use this last 15 minutes if nobody else wants to.
Fire away.
One thing that's been a challenge in the transition in the role, the new role that I'm in right now, is establishing buy-in from maybe just one specific facet of the business. It feels like there's been, you know, onboardness and adoption from most areas, but there's like this pocket of resistance. And without having complete buy-in from my leader, when I say buy-in, I mean he, you know, he'll be in the meeting, but he'll be disengaged, or he'll be in the meeting, but he's on his phone, or he'll be, you know, and it's like, it's kind of like being sandwiched in between, like, all right, let's get everybody on board. And then you've got this kind of apathetic leader, you know, at the top, but then you've also got this pocket of resistance. And then like, mm-hmm. there's me and then some others who are like, come on, everybody. And we're adopting a new system of working together, which is going to help address one major pain point that we identified as a group, is that people lack understanding about how their efforts contribute to the broader goal of the business. And so in research to help align teams, OKRs as a way, objectives and key results as a way that we've implemented that, or we are implementing that. It's a process. And there's been resistance from a specific area. And I think it's really just maybe misplaced frustration that they may have about other things, or I'm trying to think of ways to not take it personally.
What I'm trying to do is
just teeter that balance between holding people accountable to the expectations that we have, as well as finessing it in such a way where we don't completely disengage an already fragile. I feel like this particular team is already somewhat in a fragile state, and that some of their frustrations are probably rooted in things outside of what we're trying to do, but then being compounded by what we're trying to do, if that makes any sense.
It does. So what is their stated complaint? Their stated resistance to this approach?
Well, there was no complaint, particularly to what I'm trying to implement. There was just simply no participation. And it was clear about what the expectations were. Hey, next time we meet, each team is going to bring this. We're going to share and discuss, and then we'll make refinements from there. Mm-hmm. And it's in an effort to make sure everyone understands who does what in order to achieve this. And for the most part, I mean, most teams were with it and were having the conversation. And then there's one particular team with a set of individuals who completely either didn't show up or just simply didn't bring anything to contribute. And this is, you know, after postponing the meeting on for them to allow them some space to recover from. This is the customer service side of the business. And so they were impacted by just an influx and then technology dysfunctioning, and we extended it so that they would have the time to kind of catch their breath. And, you know, support has been offered. Understand this is new, everyone. I'll be in my office between these hours. Feel free to ask questions. You know, let's work through it together. It's not going to be perfect day one. Let's have the conversation. You know, just very like, hey, this is what we're doing, and I understand it's new and you're supported. But not even to ask for help or ask, you know, it's just a complete, it's almost like it is. That's where the disrespect, that's where I'm like, okay. So I had a meeting with their, you know, leader, and I'm like, look, I need you to hold them accountable, or I will hold them accountable. But the last thing I want to do is, you know, compound a situation that's already fragile.
And what was his response, or her?
He was like, okay. And I will say a little bit of backstory. This particular leader is somebody who I would classify as a toxic leader. And I've worked with him for years. You know, there's just, you know, bad thing gossip and bad things said behind people's backs coming out of his mouth. Like, this is where I feel like my leadership lacked action, where they should have taken action. And yeah, right. The problem persists.
And he's
and
not
so people like me get mad, yeah.
Yeah, no, I get that. So, I mean, again, one of the things that I try to help people with when they're dealing with effectively bad actors or toxic people And it, and there are just times where it just does not work. And you have to decide, like, what authority do I actually have? So you're doing what's called a leveraged function. He's doing a focus function. You know, focus function is mission critical to the business. A leverage function is how you accelerate that business. HR is a classic leverage function. Accounting is a leverage function, right? And so HR and accounting often demand certain processes and procedures that impinge upon focus areas. And the focus areas feel they have more authority. They're like, look, we're in the engine room. And you're like telling us we got to do this thing over here when we're in the engine room. Come on.
Yeah.
And so even though technically we're peers, I don't really report to you. And by the way, I have to do this. If it's customer service, it's usually even more so because that's ultimately a triage center. And right. Triage is always going to take priority. So you're like in an ER and you're trying to say, can we talk about what color we want the walls to be in this ER? And they're just like, what are you talking? This is
yeah.
this thing. I've yeah. ever heard. No, we're going to just get the work done because somebody's on the table. So you have compounding, you have a number of things. Even if it was a really good actor, you're dealing with a department that is by nature going to be triage.
Right.
You compound that with what may be a bad actor. So one is change your expectations a little bit because it's customer service. And understand that a little bit. Two is focus on forming agreements and writing agreements and simply saying to that person, here's what I know I need. What do you need?
Mm-hmm.
My goal in this conversation is to form an agreement that we can both honor.
Mm-hmm.
And then hold them to the agreement. You made this agreement. You didn't honor that agreement. Do we need to trade the agreement? Do we need to raise this, escalate this to a higher level so that we can have somebody adjudicate our agreements. So again, that's how you get out of kind of the personality stuff is you just focus back on agreements and behavior. What agreements do we need to form and what behaviors do we expect of each other going to the next stage? And if he says, what I need is for you to get off my back and to not bother me with this stuff. Like, got it. That's not one of the options. What I can give you is a more realistic time frame. So what time frame do you think you could agree to? I understand customer service is a triage environment and it's really hard to stop that to do this kind of work. I respect that. So I'm treating you guys differently than I would the rest of the organization because I understand you have a different role. So those are ways to help them feel heard, feel understood, feel validated, while at the same time calling them back to the table for an agreement and you're negotiating. So, you know, and I'm not saying you did it wrong. I'm just saying if you keep getting resistance and pushback, you can pivot a little bit from the, I'm going to hold them accountable or you are, to you and I have an agreement as two human beings. You haven't honored your agreement. Is it okay if I stop earning my agreement? Because I have made agreements to you too. And one of the agreements that's assumed is that we're not going to escalate this. But if you continue to not honor your agreement, I will escalate it or whatever. You know, you'd have to think through whatever that dynamic is. But that's how agreements work. I say I'm going to do this. You say you're going to do this. If you don't, then we have a conversation about it. And so anyway, that gives you just a slight shift in how you approach him so that it depersonalizes all the bad blood that's in there. Because ultimately the bad blood isn't really relevant. It's relevant to how you feel. It's relevant to how he feels. It's relevant to your beliefs. I get all that. But in this instance, what you're trying to do is clear away all of that chaff.
Yeah. And say,
hey, I understand this is an irritating thing that I've asked you to do.
Yeah.
I get that this kind of change is just know, right? If you got everybody else saying yes easily, that's rare. Like all emotional systems have an immunity to change. Change is painful to every human being, even good change. I move into a new house, that's painful. I get married, that's painful. These are good changes that I choose and it's still hard for me. So now imagine a change that I didn't choose, that I don't agree with, that I don't see the point of, and that you're not technically my boss. Yeah, I'll get around to that never, you know, like just don't enjoy this. So there are different ways to do that. I think you've done a pretty good job of staging the ascent. You know, video 12 talks about stage. Have we talked about that?
Possibly.
I'm gonna show you a quick screen share, and I want you to go watch this because this is okay. If you're doing change management of any kind, which you are doing, this is a thing you need to see. I believe it is module one, video 12 or maybe 13. It's just called Staging the Ascent. Okay. I'm gonna share this right now. Hold on. What happened to my screen share? And I'm going to give you two methods by which you get buy-in in change environments. So you can see this here.
Oh, yes.
Have you seen this before?
That's cool. No, but I see mountains in my head. So I like that this is actually, I see mountains in my head to help me conceptualize these changes. So I'm glad it's a mountain.
do you know how to climb Everest? Okay. So when you climb Everest, this is actually a map of Everest and various camps along the way. And then I've used it as a metaphor for the process that I run. But base camp is at such an altitude, you have to spend weeks there before you could even start the ascent. Then you go to camp one, then back down to base camp. Then you go back up to camp one for a week, then back down to base camp. Then you go up to camp one, up to camp two, then back to camp one, then back down to base camp. Then you go up to camp one, and then at 2 a.m, you get up and you make your entire ascent to the summit. So you spend all this time, effort, and energy at base camp, camp one, and camp two, just getting your body acclimated to what you're about to undertake. And then you make the final ascent pretty rapidly. So the goal of any change management is to introduce the experience of choice. Choice is what makes pain less painful, or change less painful. Mm-hmm. All change management is pain management. When you introduce choice, it's like aspirin. It makes the pain go away because people say, I want this, therefore I'm willing to commit to it, therefore I'm willing to suffer for it. So camp one is awareness. I know it exists. I don't understand about it. I don't care about it. I don't agree with it. You give people full permission. This is too late in the process. You're already underway, but I just want you to have this for the future. This is how you lead change. And you go, this is camp one. I just want you to be aware. I don't want you to care and I don't want you to understand. Mm-hmm. Camp two is now I want you to understand. I don't need you to care. I don't need you to agree. You're not even gonna have to change your behavior. We're just wanting you to push back, get answers to any questions you have, complain as much as you want. I want to hear your complaints. I want to hear your resistance. I want to hear you say this is stupid and I don't care. That's choice. I now have a choice. Under the corporate world, I never get choice. So I get to complain. Great. I want to complain. I think this is a dumb idea. Great. Okay. Keep going. What else do you think is bad? Right. And then you get to enrollment. Camp three is we've gone through all these other stages. Now I want you to say yes. You never, ever have to get to camp four or the summit. Those are gravy. Ownership and leadership. Ownership is it's not yours anymore. It's mine now. And leadership is I'm innovating it, taking it to the next level, making it better. All you need is to get people to camp three. And I literally use this map, show this map when I lead change in organizations. And I tell people, here's your options. Here's the goal is camp three. Some of you will make it to the summit. Some of you won't. None of you need to. Just camp three. But today, all we're doing is awareness. We're just at camp one. And I'm just letting you know it's happening. It's coming. We'll get back to this in a week. And then we'll try to hit camp two together. It is magical how this works. And I've used this in very large, very complex systems to great effect. So that's one technique for getting enrollment and buy-in when you're trying to change something in a system.
Mm-hmm.
And that is video 12. There's more to it than what I just shared. So that video will give you a lot more. So anytime you're going to lead change, that's one.
Okay.
The other one that I want you to pay attention to is the 80-20 rule, which is actually in module three. I can't remember the exact video, but it's related to Are Your People Awake is the name of the video. And that's where you talk about all the things that you as a leader have to do to prepare people for change. And one of them is staging the ascent, but that's a separate video completely on its own. But this one also talks about the 80-20 rule. Hey, thanks again, Michelle. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks for sharing today.
And so the other one is you get, you've already done this. I think you've done a version of this, right? So I'm not saying that these are things you haven't done. I'm just naming things that I think you've probably already been involved in because your intuition. But the way that the 80-20 works, pretty straightforward. You go get frontline data. What are the chief complaints, issues, concerns, opportunities, threats? Could be a SWOT analysis, could be a whatever, right? Whatever thing you're working on, you do frontline data first. You gather all the data, then you go off and strategize and analyze, and you build the solution to a level of 80%. You tell everybody this. I'm going to build the solution based on everything I hear from you to 80%. When I present it, I expect you guys to take it the remaining 20% with me. And what that does is it creates ownership, which is a faster way to enrollment, right?
Right. So
that, again, just that emotional system of choice. The 80-20 process is one way to introduce choice. There are other processes that if you can't introduce choice for some reason, like it's just something that has to happen from a top-down whatever, then the stage in the ascent is really useful. Sometimes both are really useful. So just some other suggestions to help you as you're navigating leading change in a system.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And which module did you say are your people awake?
Module 3. And module 3.
And got it. Thank you.
I can find the video really quick. Almost there.
Hey guys, I have to hop off for another meeting, but I'll see you next week.
Thanks again.
Glad to have you. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Thanks for your insights.
Oh, likewise. Bye-bye. Thank
you. Bye. Video 7. Are your people awake?
Video 7. Got it. Okay.
Module 3, video 7. Are your people awake?
Got it. Thank you, Shane.
Yeah, you're welcome. And as it relates to your entrepreneurial pursuits, how long have you been feeling this way?
Years, particularly the last two. And it's like the more I get clear on what's in here, the less I have a tolerance to not follow it. If that makes sense. So yeah. I would say particularly this year, it's been very like internally, like, what are you doing? Stop
it. Can I ask a couple of other questions just to see if anything else is rattling around for you? Do you have children or are you partnered in any way?
I don't have children. I do have a partner and we have a long distance kind of thing going on. He's in my hometown, which is about 3 hours away. But he's a great supportive partner. But so
you're not living together.
Very fortunate.
You're not living together, not married. So you're not dealing with that. So you have some freedoms. Do you have any major debts that you're dealing with? Okay. How long before those debts are paid off?
Student loan. I would say I'm finally buying a new car after 15 years. I haven't had a car payment for 10. And so I'm about to get into some debt there, 5 years for that one. I'd say the remainder of my student loan, I took advantage of the freeze, hoping that the rest of it might get canceled. But so now it kind of set me back on my timeline, but I'm about 3 years away, 4 years away from that being cleared. No, other than that, I have no other debts. Yeah, I have a pretty, low overhead, if you will.
Okay. Just wondering, because sometimes that impacts people's ability to make this decision. Strange as it sounds, in my experience, or maybe it doesn't sound strange, lots of people end up doing what you're thinking about doing. The vast majority of them end up doing what you're doing because they're forced to. That's just the truth. Most, even the really successful entrepreneurs you see out there, they were starving and they had to find something, you know, or they not starving literally, but they were like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I better find a way.
Mm-hmm.
So what's great is you do have the option of not having to go that route. And so that's pretty great. And you do have the option of planning your descent by negotiating an arrangement with your company. So, you know, that's something for you to play with also, is just to say, hey, this is kind of the runway that I'd like to have, but I want to be honest and clear and open about what I'm really thinking and feeling. And I want to contribute well, make sure you guys are in good shape. And you'd need to do that in a context of some trust, you know, so that may be hard for you to do given your beliefs you currently hold about this owner. But anyway, just some other association I was having as you were talking that I didn't want to get into on the group.
Thank you. Yeah, part of it, one of the things that has kept me here, even the last couple years where I was starting to feel very out of, was it is, you know, there's some comfort. I feel like that security can also be a prison in some ways, but I have that flexibility where, you know, if I needed to go have a meeting somewhere or I needed to go for an appointment somewhere, I don't need to like schedule it or request it or, you know, I have that flexibility, which is really important to me. And so part of me is trying to reconcile how to continue tolerating some of the things that are becoming intolerable for me, but also making a meaningful impact on the change that needs to be done here and still bringing, you know, affecting change and making a positive impact on the business while also making my raft to exit, to jump ship. And I have no idea if I'm going to get an offer for this VP role at this other place. I feel good about every conversation I've had with them. And I think, you know, I've come quite a long way in their whole candidate search. But part of me, like if I make that change, my income will increase substantially. And so that's great. But then I feel like I'm almost rebuilding in all the time energy. Like there's time energy spent here. And I feel like I would go into like prove myself mode and the time and energy would just escalate even more moving, even if it means tens of thousands or even a six-figure difference in my income. So I'm sort of struggling with, if I arrive at that fork in the road where I need to make that choice, which path is going to actually lead me ultimately to what I want. Because what I don't want to do is get so wrapped up in trying to prove myself at this new place and rebuild from ground zero there. But I don't want to stay to a big few commas in my income either.
So this is where it's critical for you to get clear on your commitments.
Yeah.
Because you will suffer for what you're committed to. So get really, really clear on your commitments. What are you committed to? Because if you're committed to, and I'm not saying either is right or wrong, I'm just giving you, this is about you discovering stuff. So let's say you realize I'm really committed to paying off my debt as soon as I possibly can so that I'm free to do whatever I need to do to start a business that I'm passionate about. Then that means that taking on a role where I make as much money as I possibly can and I lose another year to a corporation, I'm willing to suffer that because that's my commitment. Alternatively, you could say I'm committed to following my passion and my life is too short to wait on that. And signing up for a new company really doesn't have much integrity to it because I don't mean to be there anyway. I don't want to be there. And I'm just using them for the money and I'm not bringing anything beyond that. And that's unfair to them and it's unfair to me. And so I'm not willing to even entertain that. There are many other things you could conclude. I'm just telling various stories that
help you
lock in on what is my commitment and what am I going to suffer for? That's what I'm going to suffer for. You know, that's what a relationship is. When you're committed to your partner, Like, I'm committed to this partner, and therefore I will suffer hard conversations and misunderstandings, mm-hmm. hurt feelings and all that, because I'm committed to this thing. And there's some joy beyond it that's so much bigger than the thing that I'm suffering. So I think that's the issue for you, is to get clear on what is that thing mm-hmm. I'm going to do that will bring me the joy beyond whatever the suffering is. And everybody's unique, right? Your heart mm-hmm. is the only one to tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the perspective.
Yeah, you bet. Well, reflect a little and then maybe
appreciate the extra time.
Let me know where you're at. Sounds good.
Sounds good. Thanks, Shane. Bye.
Bye.
Good to see you.